Hey guys, it's Wade Conway, coach here with Movement Mortgage with Impact Coaching, and I'm getting an opportunity to dive deep into the different sides of David Culligan. Some of you guys have already obviously known him. He's been here for Movement for a while. I don't know. I'll let him tell you exactly when because he predates me. But just we're going to get into some of the things you might have seen him post on social media and his take on what's going on in the mortgage industry. So, David, how long have you been doing this?
Yeah, man. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I know I appreciate you making time for this. I know we talked about it a couple of weeks back, and both of us have busy schedules, and you definitely made it a priority to get it done. So I appreciate that.
Well, I'm
Um,
glad to
but
have
but
you.
as far as just kind of work history and movement history, I've been in the mortgage business. September was 22 years, and I've been at Movement. January will be 6 years. So really good run here at Movement. Awesome run in the industry. One that I'm just super passionate about. I still
We
love
came at the
it.
same time. January will be my 6 year mark as well. I didn't realize I'd like
January of 18.
how
Yep,
about that?
January of 18 will be 6 years. So, in current role, regional director for the South Atlantic region. So get to support our teams in North Carolina, from the middle of the state to the coast, and then the state of South Carolina, and also great state of Ohio. So that's the geography that I cover right now.
I looked at the folks that I've coached before, and it numbers in the dozens of folks that have reported to you or one time or still do. So you've got a pretty good umbrella there.
Awesome team too, man. Like I definitely have some of the best mortgage professionals in the business for sure.
So if I'm not wrong, at least have been at some time at Wells before you came here, correct?
Yeah, I was at Wells, not quite 10 years. And man, like I know some folks had frustrating experiences there. Frankly, I didn't. I was very fortunate for the time that I was there, or with the time that I was there. Very, very thankful for it. Made some great relationships, great mentors that taught me a lot about the business. Like any large organization, you know, there's got to be a lot of quality controls in place that can sometimes feel a little constricting.
Right.
But once you figure out how to navigate in a place like that, you can pretty well figure out how to navigate anywhere. So,
No.
very, very fortunate that I had the experience there, but certainly even more happy to be at a place like we are now here at Movement. Just a ton of autonomy, a ton of freedom, and a lot of upside, even in a market like this, especially in a
And
market like this.
I think no matter where you are, I mean, if you're a good people, there's going to be other good people there that you're going to have. I've got relationships from Bank of America. I spent some time there before I went out to start a business of my own, and then I left and came back to the mortgage business. So, when did you make the transition? And I guess you can answer that 6 years ago. What was it like, and what played into that for you into coming to Movement?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll keep this short, because I think it's such a personal answer that everyone may give, and this may not be resonant or necessarily relevant for a lot of others. But in 2017, that was the high water mark of my professional career, if I'm looking back and thinking about from a production
Sorry.
standpoint, certainly.
So I
But
lost you
I
at the transition that was it might be kind of a cliche type of a story, but
Yeah, well, not necessarily cliche, but for me, it was, you know, moving from a, just in summary, I was at the height of my production career in 2017. And I remember whenever I started sharing with folks that I was going to be leaving, a lot of the folks at Wells, that were and are still very close friends of mine, looked at me like, "Are you insane? Like you're the number one producer around here. You're like multi-year President's Club qualifier." It just didn't make sense on the outside. But for me, you know, it was, I saw the opportunity at Movement, and what was really appealing to me was that I saw the opportunity that I could really kind of like scale at a larger level with more friends and more people that I would have the opportunity to work with, and do things in a much bigger and broader way than what was allowed at a larger company like Wells, because of the restrictions that have to be in place to run an organization that size.
Yep.
So I went from a producing sales manager to a non-producing sales leader, and just, you know, a different decision than I think some might have made at that point. But it's one, man, that I've been just totally blessed by and very fortunate for. It's been a cool journey. Still
What's the
on it,
size?
but it's been a great journey.
So, what size of a team did you start with here? Did you inherit some folks, or did you kind of have to grow?
I'm very fortunate, man. There were a lot of predecessors that laid some tremendous groundwork for me coming in, and I just kind of took the baton and kept running with it. I don't remember headcount, honestly, but I do know that together with the folks that have since joined, we have elevated the position here in the Raleigh-Durham market, which is where I live. We took it further than it was, which is always where you want to go, right?
Right.
And about 2.5 years ago, moved from a local market leader, which is kind of a small geographic area that I was managing, to a larger geographic area, which is now that region that I referenced at the beginning.
Right.
Again, I don't remember headcount at the point we're taking the opportunity to grow things beyond where they were.
There goes my internet again. So I got most of that. So I'm going to do
trust some me, it was work. Gold. It was gold. Just was, trust me. It was all gold. Yeah.
Had the pleasure of working with, I could name a bunch. Ned Ligon is one of the names that jumps into my mind in your market for oil. And it was a pleasure to work with him. Coach him was the time that I got to spend with him. Talk to me a little bit about what your leadership style is. And I know for me, I wouldn't be where I was without other people and the relationships that I've made here. So movement relationships that you've made since you've been here, and probably people that you brought over since you've come, right?
Yeah. And honestly, man, it's one of the most humbling and gratifying things when people choose to come work with me. And it's a huge responsibility, and it's one that I'm so grateful for every day. To answer the question as to leadership style, it's multifaceted. I mean, to try to break that down in a conversation like this, I'd fall short. But one of the key themes for me is the way that I look at leadership in the context of this question is I always have to make sure that I'm a step ahead of my team, not because I'm better than, faster than, smarter than. It has nothing to do with ego, and it has nothing to do with measurables. It's a responsibility. And the way that I look at it is, these are humans. These are people with lives and families and budgets and aspirations and goals and all the things that come along with adulthood. And I take that seriously. And so I wake up every single day with a sincere drive to make sure that I'm the best version of me, both personally and professionally, so that I can pour into the people and that folks can use me as a sounding board or ideas or a fresh take on things or whatever the day calls for. But if I'm thinking about leadership style and I had to distill it down to one single thing for me, it goes back to something I read years ago in the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership by John Maxwell. And I think the first chapter, he talks about the law of the lid. And for those that haven't read it, basically the idea is that any organization is always going to be capped by the lid or the ceiling of the leader.
Yep.
And so, I've always looked at that for me when I was managing my personal sales team, when I was producing and I had the opportunity to recruit junior loan officers and assistants, and then started having the opportunity to manage and lead other loan officers. And now in a regional level, I think about every single person in my region. It is my responsibility to move that lid higher for myself every single day, to give each person in the organization the opportunity to flex. And the beautiful thing, Wade, is as I've moved into this role and I've had the opportunity to work with more and more people, it keeps you sharp, because when you've got four or five people and you're working with, you only have to worry about being ahead of four or five people, right? When you got 200 plus individuals, all of whom are very driven, very aspirational individuals, it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on me to make sure that I'm really on top of my game every day. So it's one of the things that I love about a job like this is that pressure that comes along for making sure that I'm earning my keep with my teammates. But I think about leadership a lot in that way, in that it's a responsibility to go first, to go ahead, to be ready, to have those things laid out and to try to raise a standard for everybody around me.
I love that. So let's talk about your hobby. I don't know if you call it that. Maybe it's a passion, but
it's starting to become one.
Right. I mean, first when I started seeing the mountain climbing, I'm like, yeah, that's really, really scary. And then I saw some pictures. I'm like, that's crazy scary. But when I saw the ice axes come out, I'm like, that's just insane. So how did you get started in that? Is there a gateway sport that you get into that? You start climbing a wall in a gym and then get to that point, or what?
Yeah, dude, I'll summarize it really fast. So you brought up Wells, and I'll bring it up again because so many good memories and good relationships came out of my time there. But there's a good friend of mine named Jim Young, and I don't remember how many years ago, this would have been maybe 10 years ago, somewhere in that range. Jim sent out an email to the entire geographic area, like the entire market, and basically said like, hey, I'm going on a backpacking, on a multi-day backpacking trip in the Smoky Mountains. Anybody want to join? And I replied back and thought that I was like one of surely like, I don't know, five or six people that were like, yeah, sure. I didn't really know Jim at the time. I like knew of him. We'd never really hung out together. He replies back and said, okay, cool. You're on the list. Here's all the details. Bottom line is like, I show up the day that we're leaving and it's just Jim and I, it's just the two of us. Don't really know the guy. I'm borrowing a sleeping bag. I'm borrowing a backpack with all the gear, everything that I took with me, I borrowed. And so, we went out and spent a couple of days up in the Smoky Mountains and just, I had a blast with it. Got back and started like venturing out into backpacking trips and things on my own. And really just kept pushing the envelope a little bit. Like I'd go a little further, I'd stay out a little longer, I'd take a little bit less gear each time, just trying to like up the experience a little bit more, make it a little bit more fun. And somewhere along the way, I got the notion that it would be cool to try to do some high altitude mountaineering. And so in the sport of, or in the discipline of climbing, you have a couple different disciplines. You've got rock climbing, which consists of like sport climbing or trad climbing, as it's known. You also have something known bouldering. And then you get into what's called mountaineering or alpinism, which is typically very remote areas, very high altitude, technical terrain. And sometimes you kind of stack on top of these long approaches or these long hikes. You also start stacking on top some technical aspects, which would include rock climbing on a high mountain or ice climbing to get to certain places where you can like access different parts of the mountain. And so I signed up to go climb Mount Rainier out in Washington through a guided service out there, not really knowing much about it. I mean, truly doing very little research. I think this was 2017. And the fail rate or the success rate, depending on which way you look at it, is about 50%. Yeah. So Rainier is very close to Seattle. It's a beautiful mountain, several different routes up. The easiest route is typically referred to as the Disappointment Cleaver route. And because you have to get a permit in order to attempt the summit, there's a record of every attempt and there's a record of every successful summit attempt. And true to form, 50% of the individuals in my group did not make the summit. I was one of the fortunate 50% who did make the summit, and just got shredded. I mean, Rainier, for those who don't know, it should never be your first mountain. it was incredibly difficult, to the point where I got to the summit barely. I mean, I barely physically and mentally made it to the summit. And just literally started crying. I mean, it was like, I was so emotionally and physically spent and exhausted. It's hard to describe. It's 14,000 and change high. You're navigating snow and ice and objective hazards known as crevasses, which are gaping holes in a glacier that can literally swallow you whole. And like, and this isn't hyperbole, but like,
oh, I've seen some nightmare videos about that.
You may never be found again. And I mean, some of them are literally 3 feet deep. Some of them are 300 feet deep and you just don't know until you drop. So, but all these things, that was my first experience in like real mountaineering. Was real fortunate to come back and looking back at it, I remember calling my wife on the way down, which this is usually how most of my big adventures end. Like right after I call my wife, or if she's with me, I'm like, I'm never doing that again. And sure enough, I do it again. So that was how I got into it, Wade. It was a bit of a whimsical decision to go after it. Had I known how difficult it was, I probably would have tried to stair step into maybe some smaller mountains or less objectively hazardous mountains. You know, those who know me would probably say that that's more my style than trying to go easy. I'm usually kind of go all out kind of guy. So that was the first experience.
So this, I mean, it's not about staying in shape. Obviously you could go to the gym and get on a treadmill. There's a lot of things you could do.
Yeah.
About staying in shape. I mean, you shared with me a little bit before you had a journey.
Yeah.
Where you weren't in shape.
Yeah. Yeah. In quick summary, guys, like, you know, my 20s were spent really focused on a lot of work. I was married my high school sweetheart. We got married. I was 19. She was 21. A year and a half later, my son was born. 3 years later, my daughter was born. So I'm 24 with a 3-year-old, a newborn, and had been in the mortgage business for a handful of years. We'd had the good fortune to acquire some real estate. We were in a pretty good financial spot, but man, a 24-year-old with two young kids, some real estate, and you know, 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, those are the years that are approaching at that point in my life.
Fun times.
And so it got heavy. It got real heavy. And, you know, no pun intended, I got real heavy too. I was working all the time. I was drinking to, kind of like take the edge off at night. I was not doing anything physically to stay in shape. I really wasn't spending a whole lot of time on my mental or emotional health. And so, yeah, the 20s were good year from an acquisition of wealth perspective,
right?
And not a good decade from a balance of health. The 30s kind of turned it around, and that's part of the journey. Like when I went and climbed Rainier, and part of that was just sort of a story arc of me just trying to find things that inspired me, that challenged me, things that were tough. And that's part of, and you know, we can get into some of the more nuanced stuff around it if it's interesting to you, but when you talk about ice climbing and some of the other more technical things that I enjoy doing, part of that is just sort of like building on things that I've learned or things that are now a little bit more inspiring or a little more intriguing. And then just trying to kind of find what those limits are within reason, within safety. Like I've got, my son's about to be 19. My daughter's about to be 16. And I like coming home. Not doing things irresponsibly is a big part of
my question. Have you ever entertained taking one of them with you, or have they ever expressed an interest in going with you?
So, again, going back to this idea of I'm not good with moderation, and I'm not good with what I would perceive as mediocrity. And so it's hard for me to dial back on things. And so, when they were younger, I would try to take them on adventures. Inevitably, I would just end up crushing them. And they were really good sports. We've gone on some cool backpacking adventures. We've gone on some cool family hikes. But as I've gotten older and I've gotten a little bit more adventurous in what I'm willing to do, their desire to accompany me has kind of fallen off. So they've got their own hobbies. They've got their own things they're into these days, and it may come back to the mountains. But at the moment, I'm solo on these adventures.
I'm curious about something. So you got out of shape, which doesn't seem to fit your personality to me.
Just to be clear, like when I say out of shape, I'm 6 feet tall. I weigh about 185 pounds today. I was 260, 265 for most of my 20s.
That's 70 pounds over your
fighting weight,
like, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, and that was, I was not bodybuilding. So that was not muscle. that was not a healthy physical version of me.
So the reason that I asked that, I mean, that stands outside of the personality profile you're telling me, which is someone that's very driven. So it begs the question, as a coach, I always want to know, I've gone to listened to a lot of our coaches talk, some great public speakers out there. And I was always told, you don't want to miss any of this, because you never know when there's something that someone says that's going to flip the switch that gets your attention. And somebody posed a coaching question like that to me last year, and it was an indictment about it. And then I'm going to share it with you and just going to see what it was for you. So the question was, are you intentionally making decisions that have an adverse effect to your health? And it's that damn intentionally that killed me, David. It's like, intentionally, well, I'm not eating like I should. And I mean, I'm smart enough to know things that I shouldn't be eating. Maybe I don't know everything exactly what I should be doing with diet, but I know I'm drinking stuff that I shouldn't be drinking, eating stuff. And so I've got some responsibility there. So I didn't want to actually say intentionally, but the answer had to be yes.
And yeah. I have a ton of like empathy and grace on this subject, and I don't pass judgment. I don't offer any like outside opinions on what someone should look like or feel like, or what someone should be inspired by. Like I think part of me, because of the journey, and the reason like I'm really clear about talking about this part of my journey, is because I don't want people to think that they hear me talking about, whether it's like the physical aspirations I have, like the adventures that I want to do, or the things that I have done. It's just really important to me that people understand that I'm not in an ivory tower somewhere, just some like athletically gifted freak that just goes and does these things. I have a ton of empathy for people where they are at various seasons of their life. And for me in my 20s, it was not like all of the energy and intention that I put about having a balanced life right now I put that same energy and intention into building wealth and building my business, but I just didn't leave any space for the balance. I didn't leave any space for like the physical health or the mental health or the emotional health or the relationship health, frankly, like with friends and family.
Right.
And so it was just so out of balance.
You were driven. Period. You're just driven with your focus that left other things out. Would you change that?
Very true. Yeah.
You had a chance to redo any of that? Was there any?
You know, it's hard. Like, it's a really interesting question, and it's one that's been posed before.
Sure.
I don't like the idea of revisionist history, only because there are so many, like, frankly, like, would I be as empathetic about this conversation as I am today if I didn't have that experience, if I didn't have the experience of, fair, you know, question. Like, one of the things that, like, I think about vividly is, like, I grew up playing basketball. I still play basketball when I have a chance. I love playing basketball. But I remember at some point, late 20s, I'm going to the YMCA with a group of guys I've played ball with for literally decades, like really, really good friends of mine. And I'm sitting down on the bench to get ready, and I pull up two knee braces and I'm tying up my ankle brace. And then I sit up and I'm like, I look like RoboCop, like from the waist down. Like, what is this? But it was all necessary in order to carry the weight that I was carrying just to be able to go out there and play a little bit of basketball with my friends. So, but man, that was a season of life I was in. That was an experience that, like, would I change it? I think the answer is no. I often wonder, like, how powerful we as people could be if we could go back, knowing what we know at various points in our life, and kind of like start that year over, start that decade over.
Right.
Yeah, but like, you know, that's not life. Like, time is a linear thing, right? Like, we experience it in one direction, and I think we stack these experiences and things on. And if you do it the right way, hopefully you become a very layered and very thoughtful and considered individual because of the accumulation of these experiences, good and bad, that you've had along the way. So I try to accept, you know, what happened, and try to accept what is happening, but also try to aspire to things that I want to happen in the future.
So was there a eureka moment that got you, like, or was it progression that happened?
There are two, like, really big inflection points. That one I just shared with you was one that's like a vivid memory. Another was, my son was, I don't know, he must've been four, maybe five. And we signed him up for Little Kickers, which is like a little soccer thing that was local in Wake Forest, North Carolina. And I remember sitting down at the end of the staircase to take a picture with him. And I saw the picture of me holding my son, and all you could just see was just not, like, it was not me. I didn't recognize the me in that photo. And that was another point where I was like, I need to do something. And honestly, Wade, what I did is something that, like, I've literally continued to do ever since that moment. I signed up for a 5K race, like, shortly thereafter. I couldn't tell you if it was the day after, 2 days after, but I said, I need to have something that inspires me, motivates me, excites me, and I'm going to work towards that thing. And honestly, ever since that moment, if you ever ask me, like, what are you training for? I always have an answer ever since that moment. And that's 10 years back now, because I've learned, for me, one of the best ways for me to keep my life in check is either to have some sort of, like, personal goal, some sort of personal physical goal or professional goal. But I am a very goal oriented, like, let's move towards this thing. And that's helped inform my life and inform the decisions that I make along the way.
No, I love that. It just makes me think back to, at one point I was a really, really good golfer, and I've kind of given that up, but I'm wanting to re-embrace that. Got a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I'm getting them involved in it. Part of it is, so much of my identity was wrapped up in that. But also, I know when I played at my best, there is a certain level of fitness, even in golf, that's, especially as you start getting older, for trying to keep yourself from getting injured, that you've got to maintain. So having something out there, I've got a coaching analogy for that. So I'll talk to people about doing a class. They want to teach a class for realtors on reverse mortgages or whatever it is. You know, and the concept I call it is clearing the date, which basically means, here's the date and when I'm going to do this class.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is when I'm going to do the 5K. Everything else works in reverse after that. And then you've got to figure out what you got to do. But when you commit to do that, so when I'm coaching somebody, I'm like, okay, we got to clear the date. So by this particular time, you've cleared the date. There's not anything else on your calendar for that. You know, the conference room's open. You know what topic you're going to be talking about, so you can start marketing it. So I like that idea. So
I've heard it said too, succinctly, commit and figure it out. And that's something that I think about a lot. It's, I don't know who said it. It's not my concept, but it's one that I've definitely borrowed from over the years. If there's something that means enough to you, like if you know it's important, even if it scares you, like commit and then figure it out, commit to it, put it on the calendar, clear the date, whatever usage of the words you want to put together in whatever order, like make that mental commitment, tell somebody about it, follow through on it. That's a huge, huge proponent. I'm a huge proponent of that philosophy.
I can't think about anything that would be mentally harder than for a lot of people, maybe public speaking from climbing with an ice axe. I mean, I've seen pictures of you, like, it looks like a frozen waterfall or something. You're
climbing. It is. Yeah. Typically. So ice climbing is like a really fun, offshoot it's a fun winter discipline. But literally you go find frozen waterfalls and sometimes it's running water. Sometimes it's water that it's not a typically like a raging waterfall. Sometimes it's just water that drips over an edge long enough and it freezes. But it's beautiful, man. One of the things about ice climbing that I love, and this gets into the little bit of geeky, I don't know how you can deconstruct this into like some life lesson, but one of the fun things about ice climbing is it is very ephemeral. It is very transient, and the line that you climb today may never exist again. Right. Like literally the ice may not form. The temperature may not be right next year. Mm-hmm. The rock fall above may shift water in a different direction. So one of the things that I love about ice climbing is the experience is so present, and you do have to be very aware and very present. There's a rule in ice climbing. It's like the only rule in ice climbing, and it's don't fall. And that seems like logical with all climbing, but
I think I saw you break that rule one time.
Well, don't fall and flip. Like that's, I've definitely, so in climbing, there's a term called a whipper where you basically you're falling off a climb. But one of the things that makes ice climbing so dangerous is every point of your body is a point. So on your feet, you have what are known as crampons, which are effectively spikes that you literally ratchet onto your boots. And then in each of your hand, you have what are known as ice tools, commonly referred to as an ice axe, but everything is sharp and metal and your body is not. And so if you end up taking a wrong turn, or the ice breaks, or you don't have clean technique and something falls, your feet can clip into your leg, your tool can come into your chest, like all kinds of bad things can happen when pointy things hit soft body parts. So, but ice climbing is, you know, it's a cool discipline. It's a fun experience, partly because of really just kind of cherishing the moment that you're in, because that moment, that climb, that line may never be there again. Could be next year, you know, it could be there in 10 years, but you may never climb it the same. You may never be in the same physical space you're in. You may never be in the same fitness level. So really just learning to kind of cherish each moment and cherish every opportunity when you get up there. And I think there are some parallels that we could all take from something like that, is just recognizing, you know, just the fleeting nature of time and kind of who we are as people. And when there's an opportunity in front of you to live, laugh, love, do all the things that humans do, like really, really be present and aware of that opportunity at that moment.
I've done a little bit of talking and some coaching on that as a golf instructor. If you've ever played golf before, one of the sayings that I've heard before is, you know, an average golfer may be able to play 9 holes and not play well, and kind of have a mental reset and then go back and play the second 9 holes in a better frame of mind. And a better golfer plays 1 hole poorly and can kind of reset and go and play the next hole.
Yeah.
The best golfers are playing one shot at a time. And Bob Rotella, one of the favorite sports psychologists, said the last point in a good swing routine is acceptance of the last shot, which means you got to leave the past in the past. But speaking about, you know, where we're at in the market right now and staying present, how important do you think that is as a discipline now for people that it's not like what it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
No, I think it's, I mean, it's an incredible insight you have. And more than just ice climbing, you know, where the type of experience that I like to have in the mountains is, if I could describe it kind of like car to summit and summit to car, it is a long, arduous hike up. So hiking typically through, you know, through forests, through meadows, through something at a lower elevation. And as you're climbing higher, you know, oxygen gets thinner. Your body starts to feel heavier. You're not recuperating. You're not recovering as fast because of the lack of oxygen. And eventually, you know, you're getting into snow and ice, and then the pitches start to get steeper and steeper and steeper. And then the real climbing starts. Like, after you've virtually exhausted yourself after climbing miles and miles and miles through pretty difficult terrain, and then you get to the base of where you've really got to like turn it on. Like, you've really got to be able to go to this mental place of, I know that I'm ready. I know that I've put in enough training. I know I've put in enough hours. But then you also still have to be able to control your mental state to be able to be calm enough and present enough to like accept and then move. But what one of the things I think about a lot right now in this market that we're in is, when you're on a big climb and when you're in big mountains, and I've been on some really fun mountains. I've never been to Europe. I've never been to Asia. I've never been in the Himalaya. So this is just one guy's amateur climber experience, but it's one that I'm really passionate about. But I do go after really technically challenging climbs.
Like, and nothing looks amateur to me of what I've seen.
I'm saying this as precedent, because there may be some folks that watch this that or listen to it and realize like, this guy's like very amateurish. And in the echelon of like real mountain climbers, okay, I totally am. Totally accept that.
There you go.
But one thing that I learned early on was this mantra of, one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. And so much of that informs my professional life these days, especially in this market right now, because when you're on a big mountain, man, like, it's rare that you can see the summit, because it's usually shrouded either by clouds or ice or mist or another false summit or who knows what. There's tons of things in your way.
You can't see up that street.
It's incredibly steep. Now, from far away, like starting the climb, you typically get a glimpse here or there. You kind of know like, okay, I'm like moving generally in the right direction. But when you're on the mountain, like, all you can see is whatever's directly in front of you and your own feet. And all you can hear is your breath. And it can be demoralizing, frankly. Like, it can be really, really demoralizing, because you can't see the objective. You can't see the summit. You can't see the hero pose that you're hopefully going to get if you get up there. All you can do is just remember, I've got to take my right foot and move that forward. And then I got to take my left foot and move that forward. And then you got to keep doing that over and over and over for 12, 14, 18 hours. And it's one of those things where, in this market, we're used to seeing the finish line a lot more often than we're seeing it right now. We're used to crossing the finish line every 30 days with a bucket of wins. We're used to being able to throw up these big numbers, and all the families we've served and all the agent relationships that we've won and all the things that we've done with our business and our career. But right now, man, it's like there's false summit after false summit after false summit, and it's so freaking steep. And so one thing that I try to remind myself, and I try to remind those in my team that will listen, is you got to focus on the here and now. You got to focus on, are you maximizing the opportunity in front of you right now? Are you taking one step and putting it in front of the other and moving through that process each and every day? And surely through the week, through the month, through the year, you may get glimpses of the summit. You may get glimpses of, I know I'm on the right track. I'm moving in the right direction. I can see where I'm going. But it's not always there. And you've got to trust that, like, you've got good beta, you've got good information, and you're moving in the right direction. And you just have to keep that up. So I know it's a long-winded answer, but it is the parallels that I've learned through my experiences in the mountains. And I've, you know, we haven't talked about it, and I don't know if there's time for this, but one of the things that I do to train to be able to move through the mountains efficiently, is I do an awful lot of running. I picked that up in late 2019. And I've run several 50-mile mountain runs, just in a single day. several other, you know, similar distance runs in the mountains. I do everything from a running standpoint in the race perspective in the mountains. I've never done a road race. So
what is the one that they do up in Gatlinburg where lots of times nobody ever finishes it?
I think you're talking about the Barkley Marathon.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
I don't, it's outside of Gatlinburg. I think it's in Frozen Head State Park or something like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I think what you're referring to is the Barkley Marathon.
I think you're right.
And that one is, that's the granddaddy of them.
Bucket list there.
I don't know that I'll ever be able to be in enough running fitness shape to be able to make that happen. But that is, that's a pretty cool one.
Yeah. When I've read about it before, it's like, lots of times nobody finishes it. I'm like, what is that?
It's
like,
wild. Yeah, it's wild.
So one of the things you said brought another golf analogy before, which is detaching yourself from the results and just absorbing yourself with the process. This is especially true. One of my favorite golfers of all time is a guy named Tom Watson, and all the young guys now, never even heard of him, but back in my time, he was my favorite. And there's two things he was known for. One is he had the mental ability to go out there and play no matter what the weather conditions were like with the right attitude, if it was perfect. And that gave him such an unfair advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is going out there complaining about the weather. And, you know, you've kind of lost before you've ever started.
Yeah.
When you start down that negative path. But he actually had a challenge for a long part of his career. When he was younger, he had would charge putts from any distance, and he'd knock the ball easily 5-6 feet by almost all the time if he missed it. And we'd constantly make these comeback putts constantly. But he got later in life where he wasn't making those. And part of my mind, I went back to an article that I read when I was a kid, and he wrote it. It's called Putt Like a Kid Again. And that's what it was about. It's detaching yourself from results and just hitting it. You know, that's what kids do. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about right now in the market is you've got to go through the process and not be overly absorbed in the results, because they're not going to be the same as they were in 2021 or 2020 for that matter.
Yeah. And it's hard, man. I mean, I'm a results oriented guy, and like, until this summer, and again, like it's not like I'm a professional mountain climber, but man, I've climbed a lot of mountains in, I don't know, 6 years or whatever number of years. It's been about 6 years since I've been climbing. I've climbed a lot, like dozens at this point, some really well-known high altitude, some really technical peak climbs that people probably don't know. So I've climbed a pretty good gamut of experience, and didn't make it to a summit this summer. First time ever in my life. I was with a climbing partner, a really good buddy of mine. He got severe altitude sickness, and so we had to descend, and that's the only reason that I didn't make it. Who knows? Like, I don't want to put the blame on that. But up to that point, I'd never not gotten to the summit of a climb that I was on. Okay. And so like, results matter. So like, I'm always thinking about results. But what I take out of it for me in this conversation, in this part of the conversation, is if you get absorbed in the results, you miss, for me, like if we're talking about the mountains or if you're talking about putting, if you're thinking about the end result and you're not paying attention to what you have to do at this moment, for me, it's like, it could be like a life or death situation. And I'm not trying to create hyperbole with that or sensationalize it. But if you're not paying attention to the hold that you're pulling or the place where you're putting your foot or where you're putting your protection, if you're not engaged in the here and now and really focused on what eventually will hopefully get you to the end result, right, the end result doesn't matter. So you have to be so focused on, and I can't tell you how many times, Wade, I have been surprised by a summit where like I'm just so dialed in, so focused on the move, so focused on making sure that I'm doing it the right way. And suddenly you just get there and it's like, oh, I guess I'm at the top. There's nowhere else to go. And that's one of the best experiences, when you're just so focused on the process and you're so focused on the progress that you eventually find that you're there. And I think, you know, there's truth to that in your professional life too. If you can just be, and it's hard, again, you have to be disciplined. You have to be focused on making sure that you're moving each step forward. It's really cool what you can look back and realize you've accomplished, though, if you can do that consistently over a period of time.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I get, and I think there's some, maybe some nuances here about letting the results take care of themselves. Say not, it's not caring about the results. Obviously, we care about the results. You want to win golf tournaments or shoot personal bests. I think what it is that it's, I'm going to go off on a wild tangent here. It's almost like quantum physics. If you've ever studied about quantum physics, they say by observing, the observer can affect the outcome.
Yeah.
So if you're too focused on what the outcome is, the process can get disrupted.
Mm.
So, and there's some really interesting good books out there in golf. One of the better mental books that I've read about golf has nothing to do with golf. It's actually written by a guy that was a tennis coach called The Inner Game of Tennis. And I recommend it to anybody. You heard of that about that before?
No. I'm a like avid reader. That's one that I haven't heard of.
I'll tell you the gist of it, and then you see where we go from there. And we may need to wrap it up, because I know you've got some things to do. But the author's Timothy something. I'll have to go look at that again. I've got, he also wrote one, The Inner Game of Golf. It's like chicken soup for the all these different souls, right? Turned it into an empire. But here's the teaser of it. So he was a tennis coach, and he had the idea that just like golf coaches, sometimes the instruction got to be so technical as opposed to like a dancer teaching somebody ballet. They don't teach them every individual move. Usually what they'll do is they'll show them a piece of a routine.
Okay.
Several moves, and then they'll mimic that. And the problem with golf is, and if you get what's called purpose tremor, when you get too focused on doing the motion, you're breaking it down to little pieces, your brain doesn't work right. When you're in your analytical part of your brain, the timing part of your brain doesn't work.
Yeah. So
you actually learn in the creative side of your brain, and your timing is in the creative side of your brain. Your analytical side doesn't, it's associated with that. So when you go and deconstruct some of the best performances in golf, what you'll find out is, what were you thinking, Mr. Palmer, when you hit that incredible shot? And he goes, I don't actually even remember hitting it.
Yeah.
It's like, how could that be? You know, and it's that whole being in the zone out there. Does that go on in mountain?
Yeah, I mean, you hear it referred to a lot. And I know it's been studied in various other disciplines, like in athletics and also in work. But you hear it referred to as the flow state. And you definitely, if you're doing it right, you can get into kind of a meditative flow state when you're climbing. It's not that you're disassociated. It's not that you're paying attention, but you're just so engrossed in that movement. And, you know, like sometimes you have to stop and think through a very complicated series of movements. Sometimes you have to stop and do, you know, route finding that requires a little bit of cognitive input. But often, you know, the most beautiful experiences and kind of what I talked about a moment ago, when you kind of just arrive at a summit, often it's because you're in that flow state. And you're just simply moving. You're simply like doing what you know you should be doing. And it's one of those things, man. It's like muscle memory. It's which is why I'm such a big advocate in the professional world of like, if I ever teach somebody something in my region, I always, before we wrap up, say, okay, well, tell me that, like, teach me now.
Right.
Because I want them to have that experience of, okay, you heard it, but now I want you to say it to me, say it in the way that you heard it. And I think that helps all of us kind of cement what we know when we have the opportunity to go through that experience and kind of live it out ourselves. And that's something that I've seen in climbing too, is just like being able to, you can see it, you can kind of like watch someone else do it, but when you get up there and you actually try it yourself, you really cement that experience a lot more definitely.
So I got off on a tangent. I got a little ADD talking about the Inner Game of Tennis. So this particular guy who was the tennis instructor did an experiment. He brought in a set of ski instructors, and he was working with a really high level group of tennis players.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's upper level amateurs, not professionals, and told these guys that had been working with other professional teaching tennis professionals. And they kind of got to a plateau, and he told them he's bringing in some experts, somebody that's the best people that ever worked. And he actually taught them coaching technique instead of tennis. So they weren't really focused on breaking down the motion. What they really focused on was kind of like we're talking about before, the really being present. Ask him questions like, well, what side of the ball are you hitting when you're making your four stroke? Like, you know, and by making him focus on stuff like that, you know, really, it's almost like you see some of these movies where it's feels like it was slow motion. I can almost
see
the ball spinning over. It puts him in a completely different frame of mind. These guys actually had more growth working with these group of ski instructors that he'd worked with, some coaching principles.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Got him in the present. It's a pretty neat book. So
I love it.
I recommend anybody that's working, you know, with folks out there that are the mental game is any part of it to kind of check that out.
Yeah, totally. I love it.
So anything you want to kind of wrap up with in respect to your time? Because I know we're getting close to an hour that we've been here for today.
You know, I'll just say again, Wade, I appreciate the opportunity to chat about this. I would encourage anybody listening, if you have a chance to talk about something that you're passionate about, that you maybe is like a very personal journey for you. Like for me, I mean, I share clips and bits of things that I do in my personal life on social media. I share it on Instagram a lot. It kind of flows into Facebook. But as I was thinking about this call and this conversation, what occurred to me was I don't really have an opportunity. I don't talk about climbing a lot. Like I put pictures up, I put videos up. But in my life, in my circle, I don't have a group of friends that I climb with. I didn't grow up around climbing. And so, just the opportunity to kind of like vocalize and start thinking about it, you start to kind of like understand why you do things a little bit more whenever you have an opportunity to talk about it and vocalize it. So I would just say thanks to you, Wade, for giving me a chance to kind of think through this, because as I was thinking through, it occurred to me that there are so many things that, are just kind of inherent or intrinsic to me that like I've learned through climbing and I apply to my life, but I don't really ever take a lot of time to explain it to anybody else because there's not an outlet or a forum for it. My team may differ. My team may argue and they say like my only work metaphors include mountains or sports. Like that's the full depth and breadth of my personality and my leadership style. But being able to actually talk about it in a little more depth in a long form version like this, I would encourage anybody, man, if you have an opportunity to go out and have dinner, have drinks with a friend and just kind of talk about something you're passionate about. I think there can be some cool epiphanies that you may come across along the way. So thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, I'm going to challenge loan officers out there to find something like that for you. I mean, for my life, it's been golf. I've got a different one now that plays along with golf. Raising kids has really kind of replaced that. But, you know, you can't pour from an empty cup. So I love listening to educational material, podcasts and stuff. And I do that on my motorcycle. And if I haven't got a chance to go out and do that in a few months, my cup can kind of get empty. And I've realized I've got to go do that. And I'll end up hearing something on a podcast that I can apply. And, you know, it just gives me something when I'm on a coaching call. Because if you've not been coached before, the person getting coached is supposed to bring the content of the call. And that doesn't happen all the time. And it makes it real challenge to figure out, okay, what exactly are we going to try to do? And you got to kind of teach stuff out. And, you know, if you've got some stuff that's fresh in your mind, like the conversation we had, some of the things about the ice climbing and positioning, what have you, you know, but especially if it's something that you're passionate about, does it give you a little respite from whatever challenges you might have in the day that are positive, you know, outside of gorging yourself and having another drink? You know, I can't see that there's going to be anything bad that's going to come out for sure.
No, and I would just very quickly validate that, man. It's something that I think about a lot too. And I had to wrestle with this early on as I was really trying to like get more into some of these things that I'm into now on a personal side. I'm the best version of me when I have these things going on in my life. When I have big goals that I'm aspiring towards, when I have big endeavors that I'm trying to put together. Like for me, exercising in the morning is just like, I'm the best version of me each day when I have an opportunity to do that. And that's something that happens 99% of the time. Don't apologize for the things in your life that like light you a fire, and don't be shy from that. Like if it takes a little bit of time away from other things, as long as you can balance your life and your relationships and your family and your budget and your work, find that thing, whatever it is, whether it's golf, motorcycles, climbing, crocheting, like whatever, it doesn't matter. Just have that thing that recharges you, that allows you to be the best version of you for the people around you. I found mine, and I just, I hope everybody has an opportunity at some point in their life to find theirs.
One little twist there, you said there, you know, we got about 3 minutes left, and I'm going to throw it out there and let you see if you can sum it up. But
yeah,
I know people have challenged me before, and golf as a sport has been challenged a little bit because it takes so much time. I mean, if you're going to go out and play 18 holes of golf, you figure a commute involved in there. It can be 4 to 6 hours, you know, just to get to the golf course, play golf and come back. And like, how can you justify that? Well, if you're going out with a business partner, yeah, that makes it more justified. But I can also say there's a little bit of a different angle that I've got on that is, you know, you might have heard the cliche, I don't know what you're saying is, you know, if you want something done, ask a busy person. So
yeah, sure.
Parkinson's law, and you got Horsfall's corollary, Parkinson's law. Parkinson's law says the work will expand to take up all the time that you're allowed.
Yep.
Horseman's corollary of that basically says the same thing, like it will shrink to fit the time that you give it. So what I find is that people that have other passions like that, not only that fills their cup.
Yeah.
You know, you want something done, ask a busy person. What does that mean? They get stuff done despite the fact they've got so much stuff, you know. And they probably wouldn't if they didn't have that. They'd probably find a way to waste some more time.
Yeah.
What do you think? Yeah,
I agree with it. I will tell you, I am one of those. I'm one of those individuals standing on the side saying it's too much time because I don't love golf. But 9 holes for me is perfect. But man, like those friends of mine, those teammates of mine here at work that like enjoy golf, they're the best version of them when they have an opportunity to go out and play golf once a week and really like chase that passion and do that thing. And regardless, man, like anything that brings joy, as long as you can fit it into all of the other parts of your life that you're responsible for, I'm a big advocate of it. I will just though end on this topic because this is something else that I think would be kind of a, maybe an out for some, but something that would also give grace to others. Being able to say no to things, being able to know what's important in your life and know what your priorities are, being able to say no, like that golf hobby isn't something that I'm going to fit in my life, or no, that climbing thing isn't something that's going to fit in my life. Those are the sorts of things that you should be able to say no to and feel good about because you're honoring and respecting what's important to you in your life. You just got to find the things that like really set you passionately on fire. And those are the things you got to pursue.
Love that. Don't know what we're going to talk about next time, but I want to do this again. So I'm going to put some thought in that. I hope you can put some thought in that. Let's do this again.
Yeah, man. Love it. Thanks, Wade.
Thanks, David.